This is the Afternoon Magazine on AM 580 and online at will.illinois.edu. Good afternoon. I'm Celeste Quinn. Thanks for tuning in this afternoon. That is the Harris's sparrow. Harris's sparrows winter in the central U.S. In the summer months, the birds head north, deep into the Northwest Territories of Canada. For three summers, Christopher Normand also headed north to observe the songbirds in a small stand of spruce called Warden's Grove. Why Harris's sparrows? What's the value of this kind of study? The answers to those questions and others are coming up in this portion of the program. Christopher Normand is our guest this afternoon. He is a professor of environmental science and biology at State University of New York at Brockport. His most recent book for a general audience is Return to Warden's Grove: Science, Desire, and the Lives of Sparrows. The book is both natural history and memoir. Christopher Normand says at its core, it is about the process of doing science. Listeners, I invite your phone calls for our guest this afternoon. We look forward to your questions and comments. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. We also have a toll-free number. That number, 800-222-9455, 800-222-9455. WILL. Our guest, Christopher Normand, specializes in the breeding biology and ecology of migratory birds. He's the author of many scientific articles. His first book for a non-technical audience was In the North of Our Lives, published by Down East Books. His new book, Return to Warden's Grove, Science, Desire, and the Lives of Sparrows, is published by the University of Iowa Press. 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll free, 800-222-9455. Christopher Normand, thank you very much for joining us this afternoon.
Not a problem. I'm happy to be with you.
I found the song of the Harris's sparrow at the website of the Cornell Lab of Ornithology, and an intern here at WILL, Michael Kuliska, made a loop of this song for me so as to give listeners a little bit of a longer listen, if you will. Are there other songs or calls this bird makes? Would you tell us a little bit about the song of the Harris's sparrow?
Well, in some ways you might be asking the wrong person. I characterize myself as having spent many years in the home for the singing impaired. I have a very keen ear. I'm not good at learning lots and lots of songs and remembering it. And so lots of the projects that I work on either involve working with a small group of birds like I do now with grassland birds or with a single species like the Harris's sparrow. They do have another song that begins the same way. It's got those whistled elements. And at the end, it's almost as though there's this kind of, I would almost call it like a small explosion, if you will, kind of a loud trill. And so that's the second song that I didn't hear in that particular loop. And then they also, when they're agitated, like if you find a nest or something, or you're in the vicinity of their nest, they'll make this sort of metallic chinking noise that's characteristic of other crown sparrows, like white-crowned sparrows, too.
Yeah. Well, now would you tell us about Marguerite Baumgartner and how it was that you became interested in this particular species?
Well, I became interested in the bird. As you mentioned, I had written an earlier book called In the North of Our Lives, and that was about a 14-month canoe trip across the Northwest Territories of Canada, something I did when I was in my mid-20s. And that trip involved actually overwintering on the Barren Lands at Warden's Grove. And so I spent the better part of a year at Warden's Grove and did a lot of wildlife observations. This was really before I was a trained scientist. I didn't have a graduate degree, but I knew there were a lot of Harris's sparrows there. And when I eventually went back to get a master's, and then I went back to get a PhD at University of Kansas, I was really drawn to doing a project in the Barrens, and I loved Warden's Grove, and I really wanted, in some ways, an excuse to go back there. Mm. And I've always been drawn to studying things about which very little is known. And the sort of the basic aspects of the breeding biology of Harris's sparrows had been worked out a little bit, but there was still a lot unknown. And the reason was that very few of them breed in places that are at all accessible to people by public transportation. So the only place historically has been really Churchill, Manitoba, sort of at the foot of Hudson Bay. And the earliest, so the first nest of the species was found there. And Marguerite Baumgartner actually was up there about that time and saw the bird, saw some nests, and she described it in a life history account of the Harris's sparrow that was published in 1968. And I just remember reading that once I got interested in the birds, and there was a lovely line in there about something to the effect of, when the life histories of our better-known birds were worked out, I hope that some intrepid young naturalist will discover the many, you know, something about the many aspects of this bird of mystery.
Yeah, so you heard your call.
I heard my calling. Even though I wasn't particularly young or intrepid at the time, I did decide that I wanted to pursue that for my dissertation research.
Yeah. Now, when you were a boy, you were drawn to the green spaces on maps. They indicated open space.
Mm-hmm.
Are open spaces and wilderness an antidote to our built environments? You talk about the value of knowing a place and knowing its animal inhabitants, and you call it an antidote to displacement. And it seems these things are tied together. Do you want to talk about these ideas?
Well, I think to me, I mean, one of the fundamental desires for humans is to feel at home in the world. And oftentimes I think that is difficult to do, and partly because of the pace of our life, I think that, for at least myself, I think a lot of people, we are more and more cut off from the natural world. And so any sorts of activities that can bring us closer to those environments and get us to really slow down and pay attention to the world around us, I think are ways of cultivating the sense of place, a sense of home. And I think that can happen in your backyard and as well as in the wilderness. I've just found for myself, being in an environment where, a wilderness environment where there are fewer distractions, there are, you know, the environment is quote-unquote more pristine. It's easier to pay attention, it's easier to slow down. I know when I was at Warden's Grove, my nearest neighbor was literally 180 miles away, and we had very rare radio contact with the outside. So the outside world sort of dropped away, and I didn't have to worry about all the other things that many of us have to worry about. In many ways, it was a privileged life. I mean, my wife was the one who had to deal with all the things back home, but in that environment, it was very easy to focus on where I was living and the animal that I was studying. But, you know, I really do think it can, such a process can happen in one's backyard if you are willing to slow down and, I guess, be what I would call mindful.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's interesting. My husband and I have now been talking about the right white-crowned sparrow as a result of looking at your book on the Harris's sparrows, because they're closely related, and they are now in our backyard.
Right, they're on their way north.
Yep.
And you probably will not see a Harris's sparrow, although there are records, spring migration records from Illinois. I just before I was to come on here, I was doing a little bit of searching, and I found a bit of information on that. But white crowns should be pretty common, and they're actually headed. They bred in the same area as did the Harris's sparrow, and I also actually studied them along with the Harris's sparrow, so to provide some sort of comparative information.
Yeah, yeah. So our listeners, I know that our listeners who are interested in birds will know the white-crowned.
Right, yeah. Right. And the white-crowned, I mean, in many ways, you know, if you hear, for instance, they behave in very similar ways. I mean, their songs have some of the same quality. There's, with all the Proud Sparrow songs, there's this whistled element, and many of them they also give this sort of chink call, but a metallic chink call when they're worried, and they breed in similar habitats. In some ways, they like what I call edgy situations or ecotones, most of them, and so you know, you can tell that they share a common evolutionary history just because of they have so many similar habits.
Yeah, what's an ecotone?
Ecotone is a transition between two different ecosystems or communities. So, for example, if you were to travel north from Champaign, Urbana, up into Minnesota, you will find sort of an ecotone between the northern hardwood forests and the prairie. It's a kind of an oak savanna sort of habitat. It's much disturbed now, but anyway, it's a transition zone, and I've always loved that kind of in those transition zones and feel at home there. Like the transition zone between the forest and the tundra and the western mountains, or between the forest and the tundra up in the Warden's Grove. And so I'm drawn to those kinds of environments. But there's also, I always like to think about sort of metaphorical ecotones, too, between wilderness and sort of a more urban or existence, or between science and religion. I think that there are sort of philosophical ecotones, and that kind of meeting ground are often fertile places for thinking about, I guess, concepts in new and different ways.
Yeah. Well, then maybe you would talk with us about the ecotone that you introduce readers to at the beginning of the book, the idea of science and poetry.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think you have to be careful, because science is not art, science is not poetry, and yet I think that they are capable of informing one another. And I think that too often we create these kind of artificial dichotomies, these absolute divisions between one way of knowing about the world and one way of another way of knowing about the world. And you have to be a little careful when you're doing this, but I do think that you can come up with certainly wonderful new ways about thinking about the world when you do this. And sometimes I read poetry, like, and I know there's a fair amount of poetry scattered throughout the book, and it gives me a new sense of the animals and the sort of the way in which I might look at them in sort of different kinds of ways. And I think also science can inform poetry, and I think that some of my favorite poets, like Patty Ann Rogers, are really conversant in science and know how to use scientific imagery in their writing. And I think that from my perspective, their writing is all the richer for it. But
yeah. Well, I suppose you could make the argument that being open to the arts and being open to new ways of description might lead you to maybe ask new questions about what it is you're studying.
Right.
Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. And I think that, you know, there are sort of scientists that are passable at what they do. I mean, they're sort of the journeymen or women, and they're, you know, they might have decent careers and publish some papers and you know, be considered a success. But they're not gonna ever, let's say, discover any new important, really earth-shaking new process. They're not going to develop any new theories, new hypotheses that really change, let's say, that are the direction of a science, a scientific discipline. They're not going to be involved in these paradigm shifts. I mean, some people are seem to have the facility, the ability to do that. And I think that, you know, the idea that, of actually coming up with these hypotheses, these new theories, are that's the mark of a really good scientist. And where these things come from, where these new hypotheses come from, the really creative ones, the really visionary ones, it's a mystery. And I think that there's certainly a room in sort of, I think, what I would call aesthetics I think that a lot of these ideas may come from there. And so I think that perhaps thinking about the world in different ways and can be a really fertile process.
Yeah.
I'm not sure everybody has to do that, but the world is a place that I sometimes think of as just filled with burning light, and how we see that and how we appreciate it. I think there are many different ways to do that.
Yeah, very interesting. Well, yesterday we talked with, on Thursday, the 8th of May, 2008, we talked with a fellow who was a jazz musician and a professor of philosophy. His name is David Rothenberg, and we talked with him about whales. He's written a book called Thousand Mile Song, Whale Music in a Sea of Sound. And one of the things that he said, you know, is we know so little, and even as we learn more, more and more questions are raised. And one of the things that struck me from that conversation is he said, you know, I wonder if we're asking the right questions.
That might be. I've actually read Rothenberg's book, and I've talked with him. He read here at SUNY Brockport, and I talked with him at some length about some of his ideas. And you know, I think one of his ideas that I took away from his actually lecture and performance that he feels that birds sing for joy, and that's one of the main reasons they do that. And you know, and I think he was taking a position. I mean, as I recall his talk, that was a little bit extreme. I think he was trying to provoke the audience and maybe some other people. But he's saying, you know, that we really emphasize too much sort of the functional aspects of songs, such as in mate acquisition or territorial defense, the standard things, and we don't think enough about these other ideas. And I mean, I think though that, you know, there's room for both kind of the more mechanistic, or we might call adaptive explanations, and the ones that are related to joy. But the problem from a scientific standpoint is, how do you measure joy? How do you get inside the mind of an animal and even think about it? I mean, we have enough trouble getting inside the mind of other members of our same species, that individuals speak the same language. I mean, think about trying to understand the mind of your spouse or something. It's not always easy. How do we get inside the mind of a Harris sparrow that's got a brain about 1 gram in size? I mean, and it's just, you know, I mean, some of the same physical properties there, but their world is completely different, you know. And I think that when you start talking about emotion, you start talking about complex and sort of subjective experiences, it's very, very difficult to see how you might do that in a scientific sense. It doesn't mean that these things don't exist and they're not important to think about. I think they are, but you know, how you get a handle on those is difficult.
Yeah.
Now, Rothenberg's a very interesting guy. He's very entertaining, I think, and very persuasive in his arguments.
Yeah.
But there's people who study song out there who I think he's told me some stories don't want to have a lot to do with him because of his approach. And I'm not saying that Rothenberg's approach is wrong or these other people's necessarily entirely right, but I think in some ways he's speaking a different language, albeit a very interesting one.
Yeah. This is the Afternoon Magazine. Our guest this afternoon, Christopher Normand. He is a professor of environmental science and biology at State University of New York at Brockport. His most recent book for a general audience is Return to Warden's Grove, Science, Desire, and the Lives of Sparrows. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, you can join us this afternoon with questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 333-WILL, 800-222-WILL. Well, let's talk about the Harris's sparrow. We talked a little bit about they're somewhat like the white crown. What does the Harris's sparrow look like?
Well, it's one of the largest sparrows. It weighs large sized male can weigh up to about 40 grams. So, and if you translate that into a language most people can understand, that's equivalent to about a handful of raisins, about 60 raisins worth of bird. In breeding plumage, they're actually somewhat more striking in appearance than many of the sparrows. They have both males and females have a black crown, a black nape, and then they also have a black bib. And so they're very striking, and they have this kind of pinkish orange bill that really stands out. And but when in the non-breeding plumage, in the time when, let's say, most people in the States would see them, and when they're in the central Great Plains, and they've gone through their post-breeding molt, they've lose a lot of that sort of dramatic black coloration. They still have some black, and you can tell they're Harris's sparrows, but they look a bit drabber. In fact, the picture that's on the cover of Returns to Warden's Grove is of non-breeding birds, and I was saying, well, why didn't she use breeding ones? And they were, well, we couldn't find any. That this is from actually was taken in a museum display, and the display was of wintering birds. So they lose some of their magnificence. But anyway, they're pretty. From my perspective, they're quite striking.
Yeah, yeah. And the white crowned, I love the little dance they do when they're looking for food on the ground. Do the Harris's sparrows do that?
Yeah, they do that. They kind of kick back with. Yeah. I think I assume what you're talking about is how they kick back with their hind legs,
yeah,
their legs, and yeah, they kind of scratch in the ground, and they'll do that. Same. Yeah. When you look at a white crown, you look at a Harris's sparrow, you can tell you're looking at two very closely related species.
Yeah. So Harris's sparrows, I assume, are on their way.
They are on their way, and so about mid-May, they're probably. Depending on where you're talking about their breeding range, they're probably anywhere from about, well, depending upon how the spring is up in that part of the world, and I don't know, they're within 2 weeks of starting to arrive on their breeding grounds, and it'll be trickling in throughout the latter 2 weeks of May.
Now, this migration from Kansas to the Northwest Territories is 1,600 miles. How long does it take them to get there?
It's unclear. I mean, like, if you thought about an individual bird that wintered around, let's say around Kansas, it's unclear exactly how long it would take. But the birds start moving out of their area where they probably spent much of the winter in late April. And so they're really taking about, let's say, a month or so to move up to the edge of the Barrens. And they may not fly on every day, and I don't know about Harris's sparrow. Nobody studied it, but I know they've studied, you know, it in similar size species like thrushes that winter down on the Yucatan Peninsula. And, you know, they may only fly on a third of all the days that they're actually in migration.
Okay.
So a lot of days they may be refueling. The weather might not be right. Probably they pick up the pace as they get closer to the breeding grounds.
Yeah. Now, other than the changes in their outward appearance, are there other changes they undergo before they begin their migration?
Yeah, they'll load up on fat. Their mass will increase pretty dramatically. Birds can add mass at a phenomenal rate, and they may add 4, 5, 6 grams of mostly fat as fuel for their long flight. They will have molted. They will have gone through their pre-breeding molt. It's technically called a pre-alternate molt, and so they have their fine breeding plumage. They'll be heavier. And you can actually see one of the things that's neat when you capture birds. You can look beneath the skin. The skin is very is more translucent than let's say. Human, like mammalian skin, and so you can actually see the fat deposits, and they're right between their clavicles. You'll actually see these deposits of yellowish fat, and some individual I've captured right on the breeding grounds there when they first arrive, it is bulging with fat, so they've retained some during migration.
Mm-hmm. So now, let's talk about you and your preparations to make the journey from Kansas to the Northwest Territories. How do you get ready for such an undertaking?
Well, I've been on a lot of long, before I did my dissertation research, I've been on a lot of long wilderness trips, again, like the 14-month trip, which is extreme, but certainly others that were a month or two long. And, you know, the main thing is that you just you try to plan for every contingency. So, I'm having to haul along about 800 pounds of supplies and equipment up there, and including several hundred pounds of food. And so you've got to make sure you have enough food to get you through the 2.5 or 3 months that you're up there. And you can't adjourn to the nearest hardware store, or you have to have a pretty good substantial first aid kit.
Yeah.
Everything from a shotgun for bear protection to a radio that you can use for communication to the outside world. And of course, all the permits that you need and all the scientific equipment. And so it really was a process that took about 3 or 4 months every year to assemble all the equipment. And then we would, sometime in early May, we'd throw it all in a vehicle and most years we'd drive up to Yellowknife and then wait, and sometimes wait some more for decent weather in order to fly into Warden's Grove. And every year we had to wait a fairly long length of time in Yellowknife because of poor weather. This was in the days before these fantastic GPS devices and navigational equipment that you could, you know, pilots could fly just about anywhere, no matter what the weather. So mm-hmm. we had to have decent weather to find the cabin site.
Yeah. Now, you've said you've used the pronoun we a number of times. You want to talk about your assistants. And then the other thing I'm curious about is how do you prepare yourself to be in such a faraway place with a couple of people for 3 months, two, three months?
In terms of my assistants, every year I had just one assistant, really. And the first year it was just an undergraduate from University of Kansas, and the latter 2 years were personal friends, people I'd spent time in the wilderness with and before and knew them pretty well. So the first year was a bit of a risk, really, because I didn't know this guy. It turned out he did fine. But, you know, you are going in this particular case, I'm going to a very isolated situation where, you know, like I said, the nearest neighbor is 180 miles away, and the nearest town of any size, Yellowknife, the capital of Northwest Territories, is about 325 miles away. And so the distances are huge, and the isolation is, you know, as much as you can get in almost anywhere in the world. And, you know, we had a radio, but there were a lot of times solar disturbances and stuff, and it wouldn't work for weeks on end. So we were really out there. And, I mean, for me, because I'd been there before and I knew that environment, I don't think the transition was as rough as it was, particularly for my assistant in the first year. I think he really had to adjust because, you know, eventually you just get in this plane and you take off. And you have to refuel at Reliance, which is about halfway there. And then you are just, you fly, let's say it's about a three-hour flight. And so you take off from Reliance. You've refueled. Reliance is just a collection of maybe, you know, half a dozen cabins and some scattered outbuildings and stuff. And then you fly for, let's say, an hour and a half, 2 hours. And over, you know, terrain that from the air looks almost featureless. At the time of the year, everything's frozen. So the lakes are all, you know, white, and there may be some melted ground that's kind of an umber color, some frost-shattered rock, and you just fly in a bearing for a couple hours. Plane sets you down. 10 minutes later, they've kicked everything out and airborne, and there you are, yeah. Two of you. And, you know, there'll be geese calls in the background, but you're just there, and you know you are isolated in a way that I think very, very few people ever experience in their life. And at that time of the year, there's just nobody out there. I mean, 6 weeks later, 8 weeks later, there'll be canoeists, but at the time, nobody's traveling.
Yeah, I don't know if I'd be up to that.
Well, it's intoxicating. I mean, the first year, it was a little bit of a rough transition. I mean, I went through a period, partly it was this doubt about what I was doing up there and was I going to find the birds. And the cabin where we stayed at when we arrived was just a shell. The roof had been torn off of it by bears, and it was a mess. And, you know, we had to re-roof the cabin and chop 6 inches of frozen mud off the floor. And, you know, I was having trouble catching birds, and there were huge piles of bear dung everywhere. And, you know, it was a tough environment. And, but, you know, once I got back into it, it's like the memory of being there before and the isolation, you know, returned, and I was completely fine with it.
Yeah.
It's intoxicating for me.
Yeah. What is it about it that you find intoxicating?
I think there's a number of things. I mean, one of them is that, you know, your life is stripped in some ways to elemental necessities, I think. You know, it's just, I mean, it's, you know, you're dealing with the weather, you're dealing with perhaps one or two other people. And so a lot of the things that we worry about on a day-to-day basis vanish, at least on the surface they vanish. I mean, they're always there. And in some ways it is an artificial environment, I think, for most of us because we don't live out there all the time. I didn't. I mean, I had a wife, and first year I had our first and second year I had, you know, a 3- and 4-year-old daughter, and then I had our son was born, and so I had two children, and they were certainly part of my life even though I wasn't around. But I think that whenever you live a life that's more direct and in some ways it is less complicated, I think it's somehow easier to have a positive view of yourself. I mean, I think, you know, whenever we're fully engaged in something, I think that whether you're watching a NASCAR race or, you know, or a baseball game or running a race or, you know, golfing or watching Harris's sparrows at Warden's Grove, when you're fully involved in something and the rest of the world falls away from you, at some level it's easier to believe in yourself and to see the world and feel the world in a less complicated way. And, you know, people like to do that sort of thing in different ways. For me, it's being in the wilderness and studying wildlife.
Yeah. One of the things you say in the book is that you were better for the separation, for the time so far away.
I don't know. Sometimes I wonder about that. And I think the chapter you're referring to is the one that's called The Broken Compass. And the reason that I say that is that, or give it that title in part, has to do with sort of my own personal history and how I grew up and wasn't a very happy home environment. And I started going to the wilderness when I was pretty young, 14, and doing long trips. And I basically came to believe in this syllogism. I think that the wilderness is good. I am in the wilderness, therefore I am good. And I think over the years I've come to doubt that. I do think that it makes it easier for me to feel at home in the world, and I guess that's a positive thing. And I know that for many of my friends and family, it's the same way. We feel at home there, and that is better. But I think it's still easy to that moral compass can still deflect whether you're spending time in the wilderness or whether you're not in that environment. And so,
yeah.
I guess ultimately, I sort of look at it. I think there's a line from C.S. Lewis. You know, I can't remember. I think it's in Mere Christianity, but somebody's questioning him and saying, you know, well, how can you say that Christianity is this great, since helps people be better human beings, and you know, because there's so many hypocritical Christians out there. And Lewis says, well, that might be true, but think how wicked they would be if they weren't Christians. And I sometimes think that for myself about the wilderness and these kinds of activities, is that, yeah, I fail, but I would probably fail in worse ways if I didn't have this environment to help me feel at home and feel better about the world and myself.
Yeah. What was it like when you returned home, when you came back south?
Well, it's an intense kind of experience. I mean,
yeah.
I was always excited about seeing my family, and you know, and it was pleasurable to be at home. But at the same time, I mean, all of a sudden, I mean, it's you're moving from this, again, a very direct, focused, and in some ways uncomplicated life into the larger world. And there's always this transition. I mean, you pick up the paper, you know, and you read the first paper, and you know, and it's, you know, there's violence and, you know, bloodshed and people, you know, the economy and all this stuff, and you've lost sight of that over the last, you know, last couple of months. You just have not thought about it. I know my first year, you know, Tiananmen Square, the massacre there happened, and, you know, to come out and read about it and hear about it, it was, you know, I don't know, it, part of me wanted just to run back.
Yeah.
At the same time, you can't. But on the other hand, you know, it was wonderful to see my kids, and it was hard on them and hard on my wife to be away, so
yeah.
I was happy to get back. But it is a rough transition.
Yeah. Well, there's a line in the book attributed to your daughter. She says, I don't want you to be a biologist.
Yeah, I felt like dirt, you know.
Oh.
I was four at the time. But what's funny is she's now she's going to start her senior year at Lewis and Clark College in Portland, Oregon, and she's majoring in ecology, and actually this summer she got a job studying birds, so I don't know. I guess it must not have damaged her too much.
No.
To have me gone.
Yeah, yeah. Well, you know, the transition back home is tough, but also there's quite a transition upon arrival. You write about being, when you're settling in, being, you know, aware that, you know, there are grizzlies around here. And you say, you know, it's scary there at first, but you eventually, over a little bit of time, you make your peace with that.
Yeah, I mean, it was. The first year, as I mentioned before, was particularly intimidating. And part of it was that, you know, I hadn't been on the Barrens for 10 or 11 years, you know, and then you arrive, and what we found is this is shell of a cabin, four walls, and the last time I'd seen it before, it was a beautiful roof cabin and very comfortable, so you just get that transition. You know, it was particularly cold in May, and so we had temperatures down to about, you know, 9 degrees or something, and it was kind of miserable working in the cabin, and then, you know, I didn't know anything about the birds in a sense. Yes, I knew they were there, but I didn't have any search image for them or their nests, and I was having trouble catching them and, you know, wondering, here I am almost 4 years old up here chasing these birds around, and am I going to get my dissertation out of this, you know, and it was kind of a risk to go back to school, and then there were these bears, and I think that you have to reach some sort of mental accommodation with things like bears, and or wherever you are, whatever you need to confront. I've done field work in Australia, and there was poisonous snakes and poisonous spiders, and, you know, you're kind of nervous for a little while, but eventually you decide, well, I have two choices. I can either continue to be afraid of them, or I can take prudent, you know, steps and reduce my risk as much as possible and accept the fact that it's there. And there's a process, I think, that goes on. There's a poem by Wendell Berry that I quote in the book, and it says, he says, "When what I am afraid of comes, I live for a while in its sight. What I fear in it leaves it, and the fear of it leaves me. It sings, and I hear its song." And that, to me, really sums up that process in which you come to accept, you know, your environment and where you are, and drop some of that fear, because it does nothing.
Hmm. Tell us a little bit about Warden's Grove in terms of what it looks like, and maybe, you know, thinking of grizzlies, also, you know, the sparrows have some predators as well. Talk about that.
Okay, Warden's Grove is a stand of spruce. It's probably around 15 acres in size, and it's on the side of a general hill that rises about 500 feet above the Thelon. The spruce points uphill, the V of the spruce points uphill. It's widest at its base, like, kind of like shaped like a triangle. The tallest trees would be about 50 to 60 feet high, and then on either side they'd slope out to the edge because of the winds and the wind-driven ice in the wintertime and other factors. And so the trees at the edge would be 5 or 6 feet high. Cabins at sort of the southeast corner of the grove of trees, and immediately in front, facing east, there's a huge meadow, and then it slopes down to the Thelon River. So beautiful views off to the east. The river sort of does this large S-curve right in front of the cabin. It's a stunning place in many ways. I mean, it's not like you're looking at the front of the scarp of the Rocky Mountains or anything, but there's certainly at the height of summer, it's just absolutely beautiful. And the Harris's sparrows nest right around the periphery of these spruce stands in the shrubby birch that grows right around there, several feet high, most of them. And, they have their – I had to worry about grizzly bears, and they had to worry about short-tailed weasels or ermine, but primarily Arctic ground squirrels, which are smaller. They're bigger than chipmunks, intermediate in size, I guess, between a chipmunk and, of course, a much larger woodchuck that you guys would have. But anyway, they were the ones that were responsible for most of the nest predation.
It's pretty shocking to realize 40% of nests fail.
Right, and that's actually not so bad from the standpoint of small songbirds. In your part of the world, native grassland bird populations are declining rapidly for a number of reasons, habitat loss, etc. But in many areas, their breeding success is not very high, and in some studies I've seen anywhere from 70 to 80% of the nests may fail. So 40% actually isn't too bad. And but yeah, a lot of them don't make it.
Wow. Yeah. We're talking on radio, so what does it sound like, Warden's Grove, when all this activity is taking place? When all these birds are there?
It can be during the dawn chorus, it can be a real cacophony of noise. When you first arrive there, let's say in mid-May, or late May, what you hear mostly is goose music. The white front geese, snow geese, Canada geese, just huge flocks passing over, landing in the sedge meadows, and so you just got this chorus of goose noise going on, goose calls. And then once the migrant songbirds start arriving, you get this chorus of songbirds, and there's not a huge diversity relative to what you'd find, let's say, at a woodlot around Champaign Urbana, but it's very, very loud, and it goes on a long time. The dawn chorus at Warden's Grove, the height of summer, starts about 12:30 in the morning, and in the evening, there's still a good singing amount of singing at 7 or 8 at night, then it starts to trickle off. By 10, it's pretty quiet, so you only have a couple hours where it's not not a lot of noise, although in the middle of the day, it's quieter, too, but it's an intense pulse, I guess.
Yeah. We got to wrap up here, and I got a couple of big issues left on the table, and I should have been watching the clock a little bit more carefully. Yeah. You tell readers early in the book that the kind of study you embarked on had fallen out of favor, and you were asked by someone, "What good is your research?" And I'm wondering, is this still the case, or are concerns about habitat loss and climate change leading to a new appreciation of this kind of work?
Well, I think that I was a little nervous doing my project because I knew it wasn't, quote-unquote, cutting-edge research because I wasn't developing any new major theories or testing major hypotheses. I wasn't developing any innovative methods. I mean, I did a lot of sort of sophisticated statistical analyses of data, et cetera, but I was doing what I call technical natural history that involves detailed observations and measurements. And at times I think that there has been some suspicion of that recently, I think it's extremely important. I mean, on one hand, you can use the data from studies like mine to build larger data sets that you can use to test interesting evolutionary ecological hypotheses, but I also think that the larger question is, what value is there in understanding intimately the lives of animals? And I think that a poet friend of mine says that the data really are part of their stories. And so I think that these stories are important in helping us to appreciate what Henry Besson calls other nations, the author of Outermost House, and that these animals are other nations. And it's important that we understand them and somehow integrate that understanding and concern into our lives. I think partly from a standpoint of protecting different environments, but I think there's a larger sort of aesthetic and, if I can use the word, ethical and perhaps spiritual aspect to this also. We are not alone in this world.
Yeah. I've got a listener who wants to talk with us this afternoon, and we're running way down on time very rapidly here, so it'll have to be quick. Listener in Centralia, line 4, hi.
Yes, I was wondering if you can explain if the white crowns and the harris sparrows live side by side there, what keeps them from hybridizing into a single ultimate species?
They have different. They don't recognize themselves the same. I guess that their songs are very different. I found harris sparrows nests and white crown sparrows nests within 10 meters, 10 yards of one another. And watching them, they basically seem to ignore one another. There's just not. The cues are wrong. The cues are wrong. And there is some hybridization. Or occasionally we'll find a bird. I've never heard of one of the harris sparrows hybridizing with another species, but white crowns, I think, and white-throated sparrows in the same genus, there are records occasionally of hybridization, but it's just that they're seen as other. Just don't pay them any attention.
Yeah.
So.
Well, there we have to leave it. We're out of time. Christopher Norman, thank you so much for talking with us this afternoon.
Well, thank you for having me on your show. I've enjoyed it.
My pleasure. Christopher Normand is a professor of environmental science and biology at State University of New York at Brockport. He is the author, most recently, of Return to Warden's Grove, Science, Desire, and the Lives of Sparrows. The book is published by the University of Iowa Press.